From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this July 4th edition, Mary Weiss, who was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las, one of the great girl groups of the 60s. Their hits included Remember, Give Us Your Blessings, and Leader of the Pack. Weiss dropped out of music when the group split up in the late 60s. She returned in the spring with her first solo album. Also, we hear from Neil Sedaka. In celebration of his 50th year in the music business, he recently released a CD collecting hits he wrote and recorded, including O Carol, Calendar Girl, Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Laughter in the Rain. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V.
That's one of the hits that the great girl group the Shangri-Las had in the 60s. Some of the others were Leader of the Pack, Remember, Give Us Your Blessings, and Long Live Our Love. The group had a tough urban image and sang songs about teenage love that often ended up in tragedy. Some of their records were produced like mini-dramas with dialogue and sound effects. The group originally consisted of sisters Mary and Betty Weiss and twin sisters Marge and Marianne Ganser. The lead singer, my guest Mary Weiss, left music after the group broke up in the late 60s. But in March, she returned with her first solo album called Dangerous Game. The CD was described in The New Yorker as a remarkable solo debut. Quote, Weiss is in fine voice, and the songs combine the dark innocence of girl group records with a mature sense of regret. Unquote. I spoke with Mary Weiss when Dangerous Game was released. We began with the opening track from the CD. This song is called My Heart is Beating.
When you held me close, that's when I knew. Chilled me through and through. I couldn't let you go. I couldn't let it show. And this whole world's unfair. I know it's true. What can I do? One day you'll be free. You'll come running to me. Till then, my heart's beating, beating, baby. I know you've been cheating, but if I take you back, you gotta walk a straight and narrow track. I said if I take you back, I wanna know you'll be good to me.
That's Mary Weiss from her new CD, Dangerous Game. Mary Weiss, welcome to Fresh Air. It's so great to have you recording again.
Thank you.
Yeah, you really sound great on the new record, but you haven't recorded and you haven't even performed much since the Shangri-Las broke up in the late 60s. Why have you stayed away from music for so many years?
Basically, when we first started, it was all about music. And by the time we finished, it was all about litigation. And it just became thicker than the music.
So what changed? And did somebody convince you to come back now?
Interestingly enough, I was listening to an interview you did with Iggy Pop.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned life being in seven-year cycles. And I was just floored because I've always viewed life that way. And I've had a lot of things happen to me in recent years. I lost my mom. I lost my brother. And I've been reevaluating what it is I want to do with the last sector of my work life.
And why did you think you wanted to go back to music?
Because music is home to me. It always was. Music was my life as a child growing up, and it got me through most of the things in my life. And it feels like where I belong. So
it must have been horrible to not be able to perform for all those years.
Never been real fond of performing live. I'm a very private person, but I love this studio. That's my home.
So that must have been frustrating, not being able to record.
Yes and no. When I put something down, I really put it down. And I packed my bags and I went on my way. I developed a new career. I was working for an architectural firm, and I had it started in their accounting department. By the time I left, I was their chief purchasing agent, and I worked at commercial furniture dealerships, and I installed multimillion-dollar installations.
Did they know who you were?
Yeah, unfortunately. sometimes people would show up at my place of employment with an album in hand.
Let's talk a little bit about the Shangri-Las. Now, you started out in high school performing at local bars with the Shangri-Las before you started recording. And the band was initially made up of you, your sister Betty, and two twins who were your friends.
Right.
What was the band like before you started recording?
Well, actually, we met in grammar school. And we used to sing on the street corner, all of us. So that's how we really started. And not bars. I was too young to be in a bar, actually.
Right.
Little hops and dances and things like that we did initially until we went up to Bob Lewis's apartment and met Shadow Morton.
And the story of how you met George Shadow Morton, who became one of your producers and one of your chief songwriters, is a story that's kind of entered rock and roll lore, but I want you to tell it.
We had an original manager, I believe his name was Tony Michaels, and he wanted Bob Lewis to hear us singing. So he had made an appointment with him, and we went up to his apartment just to hear us, and we got up and sang for him a cappella. And George was there, Shadow, sitting there, and that's when I met him.
And he, I think, wrote this on a dare. He was trying to convince the songwriter, Jeff Barry, that he was really a songwriter and he could write, you know, a ballad or an up-tempo tune. And the song was Remember, Walking in the Sand, which is one of those, like, great, like, drama songs.
I really like that record.
Oh, I love the record. I mean, who doesn't?
I'm doing that on stage.
Are you?
Yes, I am.
Well, let's hear Remember, which was the Shangri-La's first hit, and you were, what, 15 when this was recorded?
I believe so.
Okay, here we go. That's the Shangri-Las, their first hit. My guest Mary Weiss was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las, and now she has a new solo CD, which is called Dangerous Game. Now, this song has such drama to it, you know, like when you're saying, like, let me think, what can I do? Were you used to that kind of drama in your performances?
I was used to that kind of drama in my life, so I think it would come out in my performances.
What kind of drama in your life?
Well, I think teenagers, for the most part, I can only speak for myself, but teenagers have an intensity that we seem to, I don't think we grow out of, but there's variable shades of gray added where when you're a teen, a lot of things, or for me anyway, everything was black and white. I don't know if I'm expressing myself correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us like an example of a dramatic incident that had already happened to you when you were 15 and recorded this?
Not specifically. It's just the way I grew up with a difficult childhood.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up pretty poor, and I mean, I've been supporting myself since I'm 14. So, I don't know. There was a lot of pain in me.
My guest is Mary Weiss. In the 60s, she was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. In March, she came out with a solo album called Dangerous Game. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Weiss. In the 60s, she was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. In the spring, she returned to music with her first solo album called Dangerous Game. Weiss was only 15 when the Shangri-Las had their first hit, Remember Walking in the Sand. Some people lose their bearings when they have that kind of sudden success at a young age. Did you?
Definitely. I think most... It's hard enough for an adult to deal with that type of situation, much less a child. Sure, I had a lot of problems with that.
In what ways do you feel like you were knocked off balance?
Well, I think most kids have a structured home, a more structured home than I did.
Mm-hmm.
In today's world, maybe not. But years ago, I remember people having like two parents and finishing school and, you know, more structure than I did. I grew up on the road. I had a road manager who was barely a couple of years older than me. So, I mean, kids were going to proms and I was giving press conferences in London. It's quite a weird way to grow up.
If you don't mind my asking, did guys in bands try to hit on you on the road when you were traveling in rock and roll shows and sharing a bill?
Other bands?
Yeah.
Sometimes, of course. We have such a tough image, supposedly. But
the Shangri-Las, absolutely, yeah.
I think a lot of that comes from surviving, from making people back down.
So you didn't have a tough image before your success?
I never thought much about image. I just didn't like chiffon dresses and high heels. I'm you know, that's as honest as I can be. And I never liked women's slacks back then. You know, they didn't have low-rise pants
mm-hmm.
in 1964. They just didn't make them, so I used to go to a place on 8th Street and have men's clothes tailored for me.
Did anyone like from a record company ever try to make the Shangri-Las more girlish and glamorous and less kind of tough-looking and, you know, your boots and pants?
No, actually not. What we wore on stage after we started making money. I mean, you can see the difference from early on. We didn't have any clothes. Where you saw other groups where they had money and support behind them were extremely well-dressed from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We were out there pretty much in our street clothes. But then when we started making money, we designed our own clothes and had them made in the village.
Let's hear, but talk about first, another really famous Shangri-Las recording, and I'm thinking of Leader of the Pack.
Okay.
Your first impression of the song when it was presented to you?
I really had to sit down with this one. I took it home and listened to it for a very long time before I agreed to do it.
Why were you so reluctant?
Even at the time, it was pretty much out there. I mean, in England, there was a very rigid environment, even globally. I mean, the record was banned in England the first time it came out.
Did you rehearse this song differently than you usually rehearsed songs because of the spoken parts in it and the drama?
Well, usually I'd rehearse those home initially. And I remember having hard times with certain songs where we'd actually dim lights in the studio so I could feel like alone in order to be able to deliver it properly. The Lookout took a little bit because it's kind of metered and it had to be right on the money to do. So I would just sit at home and yell Lookout. I'm sure my neighbors love that.
Well, why don't we hear the song? And this
okay.
is the Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
I met him at the candy store. He turned around and smiled at me. You get the picture?
Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for
the leader of the pack.
Small, and kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
Look out!
I felt so helpless, what could I do?
That's the Shangri-La's. My guest, Mary Weiss, was the lead singer of the group. She has a new solo CD, her first solo CD, called Dangerous Game. You know, as we were saying, the Shangri-La's had the image of being very tough. What was your neighborhood like in Queens when you were growing up?
I probably would consider it middle to low middle class.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of kids in the neighborhood. An average neighborhood. Pretty much.
What did your mother do to support you?
She had periodic jobs on occasion, but nothing really substantial.
Mm-hmm. So you were pretty much scraping by?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it must have been really welcomed when you started making a lot of money.
There you go.
And did you send a lot back to your mother?
Always.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of raised her. As much as we could.
What are you hoping for musically and professionally this time around. You'd stayed away from the music business since the late 60s. There was so much litigation. You were so kind of disillusioned with the business at that point. You stayed away for decades. What do you want this time around?
Actually, I want music. The funny thing about it now is I'm not a kid. There is no ladder I'm trying to climb. I have nothing to prove. No one can remove what I've done from my past. It is what it is. And now it's time to just have some music in my life and have some fun. I don't know. The whole thing has been fabulous. And the response is absolutely overwhelming. But I'm not looking for anything specific. I just want to rock and roll. That's how I want to spend my last days before I retire.
I'd like to close with another track from your new CD. And since I've been making all the choices, I'm going to ask you to choose one of your favorites.
Break It One More Time. Break It For Me One More Time.
Tell me why you're choosing it.
I just really like the song. I loved doing it, and I just really feel that number.
Okay. Mary Weiss, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the new CD.
Thanks so much.
Mary Weiss was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. Her solo CD is called Dangerous Game. Here's the track she just mentioned, Break It One More Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
My
support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics Edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on this July 4th edition, we talk with Neil Sedaka. He recently released a CD celebrating his 50 years in the music business that includes hits he wrote and recorded like Calendar Girl, Happy Birthday Sweet 16, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Laughter in the Rain.
I'm gonna march you down the aisle. You're the Easter Bunny when you smile. Yeah, yeah, my heart's in a whirl. I love my little calendar girl every day of the year. Hey. Maybe if I ask your dad and mom, they let me take you to the junior prom.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the late 1950s, my guest was one of the songwriters churning out hits in a Manhattan office building that became known as Pop's New Tin Pan Alley. Neil Sedaka started out in the music industry 50 years ago. To celebrate the anniversary, he came out with a new CD in April called The Definitive Collection, featuring the original recordings of hits he wrote and sang in the late 50s and early 60s, including Oh Carol, Stairway to Heaven, Calendar Girl, Happy Birthday Sweet 16, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Next Door to an Angel. It also includes recordings he made in the 70s, like Laughter in the Rain, after Elton John signed Sedaka to John's own label, Rocket Records. Sedaka's music was back on the charts 3 years ago, after he was a judge on American Idol, and Clay Aiken recorded Solitaire. When I spoke with Sedaka in April, we started with this 1961 hit. In your teens or just out of them, you had a knack for writing songs that would appeal to teenagers, maybe particularly to teenage girls, because the songs often had the message they wanted to hear, like they're growing up and becoming very desirable. Did you think about that consciously? Did you think of yourself as writing songs for teens?
Well, we were the teenagers of New York, coming from the Brill Building School of Songwriting. And yes, we were writing for the teenage market. The early lyrics or collaboration with Howard Greenfield, who was a marvelous lyricist and who could concise, it was almost the art of writing a 3-minute song, and we could tell a whole story in 3 minutes. Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, from the beginning to the end is a little novelette.
Did you always start with a lyrical hook as well as a musical one?
I always wrote the melody first, and I would prepare 2 or 3 melodies for Howie and play him that day, and whatever mood he might be in, he would choose one of those. And then it was a give and take. If the lyrics didn't fit, I would change a melody or a motif, and then he might change some things to accommodate me. It was a very close collaboration.
Most of the songwriters there were writing for other singers. And you wrote songs that other singers recorded, but you wrote a lot of songs that you recorded yourself. Were you originally hired to write for other people?
I came in as a writer the first 6 months, and my 2 of my songs were recorded. Connie Francis did Stupid Cupid, and before that, Atlantic Records, Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler took my songs and recorded them with Clyde McFatter and Laverne Baker. But about 6 months to a year into the contract, I was 19, and I had a great desire to record my own songs. And I was brought into RCA Victor. Steve Scholes, who was the top A&R man, he had just brought Elvis Presley from Sun Records to RCA. And I auditioned for him with a song called The Diary, and he signed me to a 5-year contract. And, Terry, I was very fortunate between 1958 and 1963, to the shock of my family after studying at the Juilliard, I sold 40 million records in the 5 years. So yeah. I did.
Sure, your parents were happy about that in spite of their classical aspirations for you.
My mother, in fact, was not happy at the beginning. But, you know, I bought her Ming stole, so she was very, very happy after that.
I want to play another song that's included on your new collection, and this is Stairway to Heaven. And this is an example of, like, you know, an early rock and roll pop hit that had a pretty elaborate orchestration. I mean, am I hearing a bass saxophone on here?
No, it was a baritone sax.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. And it became a trademark. I called it the sandwich song because it started with a piece of bread, climb up, way up high. And then the meat of the song was the actual lyric, well, oh, well, oh, well, a heavenly angel. And it ended again with a piece of bread, climb up, way up high. And it became a Neil Sedaka trademark, the sandwich song, I call it.
Well, another Neil Sedaka trademark is the Wella Wellas or the Come Doobie Doobies.
Yes, the onomatopoeia. I was fascinated with the syllables sung to music, and that became sort of a trademark.
How did it become a trademark, and how did you figure out what syllables to use, whether it should be Wella Wella or Doobie Doobie?
Well, it started early in the career, and it was kind of someone singing along. Perhaps they were just getting into the song and they didn't get into the lyric yet. So they were going down, doobie doo, down, down, before they began the actual song. And it was, how did I choose the syllables? The most important thing in songwriting was the marriage of words and music. And the syllables had to fit the particular melody. And I was very keen on that marriage of lyrics or syllables set to music.
Okay, so here's Neil Sedaka singing his song, Stairway to Heaven. And this is one of the songs included on his new collection, the definitive collection of Neil Sedaka. That's Neil Sedaka from his new CD, The Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka. Now, you know, we were talking before we heard that about how one of your trademarks is the, you know, the scat-like syllable things, Wella Wella, mm-hmm. or in the case of the next song we're going to hear, Dom Doobie Doobie, in Breaking Up is Hard to Do. What was the first song you did that on?
I think it was O'Carroll. I did double voice. But Breaking Up is an interesting song because I think I'm the only artist who has recorded his song twice. I did it first as a rock and roll song in 1962, and then I re-recorded Breaking Up is Hard to Do 15 years later as a slow gin mill song. And I don't think anybody else has done the same song in two different tempos. And by the way, both of them were huge successes.
Yeah, well, we're going to hear them back to back. But before we do, what made you decide to do a slower and more adult version of the song in 1975?
Good question. Lenny Welch, a great singer who had a hit called Since I Fell for You, mm-hmm. was a friend and asked if I had any follow-up to Since I Fell for You. And I was fooling around at the piano one day and discovered that Breaking Up is Hard to Do worked as a slow song. And I presented it to him. He loved it and recorded it as a ballad. And it was an R&B hit. And then I would do it as an encore in my concerts. And the audience reaction was so good that I decided to re-record it as a ballad.
And you made some changes on it. It's not just that the tempo's slower. The chords are really different.
Well, of course, it's a more sophisticated. And when you have a ballad hit, it's a career move. It's a much better career vehicle. And when you're doing it as a jazz piece, you automatically change some of the chords to make them sound like a standard, like you're listening to a Dinah Washington record.
Okay, so let's hear Neil Sedaka's two versions of his song Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, the first from 1962, the second from 1975. Both versions are featured on his new CD, The Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka.
Do 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 down do be do down down. Comma comma down do be do down down. Comma comma down do be do down down. Breaking up is hard to do. Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go, then I'll be blue. 'Cause breaking up is hard to do.
Now, of course, you know, in American Idol a few years ago, Ruben did a slow version of Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. And mm-hmm. Clay, of course, recorded Solitaire. And you were a judge, a guest judge.
Mm.
What kind of advice did they ask you? Did they give you before being a judge? Did they tell you to be nice or to take the gloves off and be tough?
Well, you know, I wanted to be tough. But my son said, Dad, you know, there are 30 million people watching. Be careful of what you say. And, you know, I think that it's a very difficult, these kids are on in front of millions and millions of people. It's a very difficult thing. But I must tell you how I got on. Everyone was saying, oh, Neil, you must be a celebrity judge. I said, oh, there are so many people trying to get on. And my publishers called and said, perhaps if you called personally to the show, you have a better chance. And I picked up the telephone, spoke to a Susan Slema on the staff. I said, hi, this is Neil Sedaka. I watch the show. I'd love to be on as a celebrity judge. And she said, are you kidding? Who is this? I said, no, it's Neil Sedaka. She said, sit there. We're having a meeting. She called me back in an hour and said, you'll be on in 2 weeks, and the five finalists will be singing all Neil Sedaka songs. I was over the moon.
What impact did it have on your career?
The catalog went through the roof. All of the old records started to sell. Amazon.com was ringing off the walls. And Solitaire by Clay was one of the biggest, I think the second biggest seller of that year.
My guest is Neil Sedaka. His CD, The Definitive Collection, was released this spring. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter and singer Neil Sedaka. His latest CD is a career retrospective of hit songs that he wrote. We were talking about how you grew up playing classical music and how your mother early on would have preferred that you play classical music. In those early days, were you torn in two directions, pop versus classical?
No, I was a very serious piano student. I started playing at age 8. At 9, I entered the prep school of the Juilliard when it was on 125th Street and Claremont Avenue. I studied with the great Edgar Roberts. And when I was 13, I discovered that I could write songs. I wasn't very popular in school. I wasn't a jock and wasn't one of the popular kids playing Chopin and Bach. So I was fascinated by the reaction I got. I was invited to all of the teenage parties, and that was a very big deal in those days, if you can play your own songs or hits of the day. So it was a twofold study of songwriting and going to Juilliard every Saturday, and then I went to the college, Juilliard College, studied with Adele Marcus. And when I was 19, I had to make a decision which direction to go. And, you know, the money is, being from a very poor family, my father was a taxi driver in Brooklyn for 30 years and worked very hard. And I think every teenager wanted to be a rock and roll star, that, you know, that would be very exciting to any kid of that age. So I did pursue it, but I never dropped the classical music because I still basically love it, and those are my roots.
In an autobiography that you wrote a few years ago, you write about a song, Mr. Moon, that you wrote when you were in high school and that you performed in high school, but the principal didn't like the song. You said, you describe it as having been a little risque for for school. I was dying to hear how it went.
Well, I was a freshman at Lincoln High School, and as I said, not one of the popular kids. And I had started writing rock and roll. It was the beginning of rock and roll, and I wrote a song called Mr. Moon, and sang it at one of the Ballyhoo shows in the auditorium. And there was to be two performances. The first performance, the kids started to jump and dance and bump and grind, and it was a sensation, except when Abraham Lass, the principal, called me into his office and said, "You know, Neil, we can't have that kind of behavior. We'd like you to do something else, another kind of song for the second performance." And there was a petition signed by the students that they wanted Neil to do Mr. Moon again. And we won, and I did it again. It was not a dirty song in any way, but it was kind of a bump and grind, chick, 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 you know, that old rock and roll tempo, which was very new at the time.
Could you do a few bars of it?
Oh, my goodness, I was 16. Mr. Moon, guide your love back to me. Ha, 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 ha. Sounds very, very fragile now. Very timid.
So what was it like for you having been an unpopular kid to then have a song that the kids really responded to? Did it change your standing in the school?
Oh, I was able to go into the sweet shop across the street from Lincoln High School. The sweet shop was divided into two parts. The first part were the kids that wore the button-down shirts, and the second half of the sweet shop had the black leather kids with the DA haircuts. And I was allowed to go into the back room with the jukebox and the leathers and the DA haircuts. They said, "Oh, let Mr. Moon go in." So you can imagine.
Are these kids who had beaten you up in earlier times?
They weren't too kind to me at the beginning.
Yeah, you know, you write in that memoir, you write, "By first grade, I was known as the school sissy. I practiced walking and gesturing in a masculine fashion in front of the mirror." So it made me think you were probably picked on a lot.
Yes, that was one of the reasons that I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to please people. I think in many instances, artists who begin as, are neglected and are made fun of, I think that they pursue these careers to be noticed, to be accepted, and to be revered. So I showed those football players.
Yeah. Well, did it make you self-conscious when you started performing about whether you should look more macho as a performer?
I studied in front of a mirror. I had a sister, Ronnie, who I adored, and she was my hero. She was 18 months older, beautiful, popular, and, you know, I had to stand in front of a mirror, I'll be totally honest with you, and learn how to move in a more macho way, how to carry my books, how to... It was a metamorphosis.
You know, I think in that era, every teenager was standing in front of a mirror, and some people were learning to dance in front of a mirror. Some people were pretending they were singing into a microphone in front of a mirror, and other people were just trying to figure out how to fix their hair or look better. But don't you think, like, every boy and girl was standing in front of a mirror then?
Yes, but I must correct you. I didn't use the word sissy. I used the word effeminate. Because I was raised by six women. We were, believe it or not, 11 people in a two-bedroom apartment in Brighton Beach. My mother, my sister, my five aunts, and my grandmother. So these are the people who I emulated. So it was a marvelous upbringing because I was spoiled by all these women.
My guest is Neil Sedaka. His CD, The Definitive Collection, was released this spring. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter and singer Neil Sedaka. His latest CD is a career retrospective of hit songs that he wrote. Now, earlier we heard two different versions of your song Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, one from the early 60s, one from the mid-70s. When did your string of hits in the 60s end? People always say that for the American pop songwriters and singers, their careers were really interrupted or ended by the British invasion. Is that too simplistic, or do you think that's an accurate description?
That's an accurate description, Terry. There was also a natural progression of 5 years of hits. The Everly Brothers, Connie Francis, Fats Domino, Brenda Lee. We all didn't have more than 5 years. But as you said, the British invasion, the great Beatles and Rolling Stones came. I wanted to write that style, and I did write that style, but my public wouldn't accept it, and the record company wouldn't accept it. So for 11 years, I took a back seat, took stock of myself, raised a family, had my two children, and wrote for a publishing firm, and had some great artists record my songs: Andy Williams, Johnny Mathis, Peggy Lee, Shirley Bassey. But you know, once you get a taste of being in front of the public, you never get over that. And it was 11 years later, around 1974-75, actually, that I lived in England. I moved my wife and children to England because in England they respected the original rock and rollers in America. And it was there that I met Elton John, who was starting a record company, Rocket Records, in America. And he was a big fan of my early records. And he knew that I was recording with a group called the 10cc's in Stockport, England. Marvelous group at the time. And I made two albums with them, and both of them were successes in the UK. And Elton said, you know, I think I could launch you again in America. And I said, well, that would be remarkable. Elton had me record an album called Sadaka's Back, which was a remarkable comeback for me. And I always thank Elton for that.
Was Laughter in the Rain on that?
Yes.
Yeah, and that was a really big hit for you.
Well, after 11 years, to have a number one record was a remarkable comeback. And Love Will Keep Us Together was on, and The Immigrant, and That's When the Music Takes Me. I was very proud of the collection.
So how much are you still writing songs now?
I write once or twice a year. I wrote some new songs that I'm working on for a children's album. I actually rewrote, since I have three new grandchildren, my son and his wife got after me and said, you know, you're Papa Neil now, you have to write some children's songs. So I came up with the idea of changing the lyrics to some of my original hits. So I did Waking Up Is Hard to Do. I did Where the Toys Are. Don't Trip Over Your Toys, Put Them Away Neatly. And so perhaps I'll be Papa Neil on television. Who knows?
I'm trying to think of a really torchy version of Where the Toys Are. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Same here, Terry. And it's a wonderful program. Congratulations. Continued success.
Neil Sedaka recorded in April after the release of his CD, Neil Sedaka, The Definitive Collection. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our 4th of July edition was produced by Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Strolling along country roads with my baby. It starts to rain.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA Craft, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at MOMA.org. And from Debbie and Norris Bishton, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Brian Ferry talks about his new CD of Dylan covers called Dylan-esque, and Carol Muskie Dukes talks about her new novel, which is based on her experiences teaching writing at the Women's Detention Center on Rikers Island. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.